If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Hello and welcome to Columbia Calling. I'm Emily Hart, and this week we are getting the inside story on the Narco Files, an extraordinary new investigation into the global criminal order and the largest investigative project of its kind to originate in Latin America. So last year, a group of hacktivists known as Guacamaya infiltrated the Microsoft Exchange server. This enabled them to hack the system of the Colombian Attorney General's office, as well as military and police institutions, regulatory agencies, and companies across the region. The Narcofiles project is based on that hack, mostly of the Attorney General's office, which is the entity in charge of investigating and prosecuting crimes in Colombia. 5 terabytes in size, the leak contained more than 7 million emails, including exchanges with numerous embassies, law enforcement, and other institutions. The Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, the Centro Latinoamericano de Investigación Periodística, known as CLIP, as well as magazines Vorágine and Cero 70, all gained early access to that data. They then shared the leak with over 40 other media outlets, and journalists from over 23 countries ended up working on the investigation. Today, we are lucky enough to have with us OCCRP's Latin America editor, Nathan Jacquard, who has led and coordinated this project right from its earliest seeds in the 2022 hack to the incredible flourishing of reporting we've seen this week and which continues to emerge. The documents in the leak reveal unique details about the inner workings of international criminal gangs, as well as law enforcement efforts to dismantle them. Most cocaine still starts life at a plantation in Colombia, but the global market is booming, and products pass through many countries and many hands before reaching the user, generating billions in illicit revenue, which flows back across the world through bank wires, cash transfers, and other transactions. The borderless nature of these crimes and the groups behind them requires cross-border cooperation by those trying to expose them. That's law enforcement and journalists. So Nathan will be telling us all about the who, what, and how of this story, as well as giving us his insights into the new world of organized crime and cocaine trafficking, which has been revealed by this hack, from the shifts in where cocaine is grown and produced to corruption in high-level officials in countries like Suriname, as well as the narco nexus between huge Colombian banana companies and the political right wing, as well as Israeli mafia in Colombia, links to the Odebrecht scandal, and stories involving fruit, shark fins, and DEA agents. I will be sharing with supporters and subscribers my top picks from the Narco Files reporting from a number of outlets, with, of course, translated versions. All of that is on its way, but first, your top news stories for this week.
The Columbia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Columbia Calling website, that's www.columbiacalling.co, or the BNB Columbia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.
Luis Manuel Diaz, father of footballer Luis Diaz, was released this week, 12 days after being kidnapped by guerrilla group the Ejército de Liberación Nacional, the ELN. The ELN, however, continues to abduct, kidnap, and retain other Colombians. According to data from the Ministry of Defense, as of September 2023 was the year with the highest number of kidnappings in a decade. Alias Antonio Garcia, commander of the group, insists that they have not violated the ceasefire with the government and that they have a right to continue so-called economic activities, including, he argues, kidnapping. The government is nonetheless demanding the release of all current victims of kidnap and an end to the practice. Garcia responded by tweeting that the government should not be under any illusions about the likelihood of that occurring. He also said that the ELN is open to discussing their financing, but it is clear that the high-profile kidnapping has shaken current peace negotiations, and the issue seems to have become an obstacle to progress. Also this week, the ELN announced an armed strike in the department of Chocó, confining the population of Alto Baldó to their homes under the threat of violence. And in other peace negotiation news, the government have responded to the announcement by FARC dissident group the Estado Mayor Central, the EMC, that they are suspending participation in peace talks. President Gustavo Petro said that the EMC had resolved not to attend the table without breaking the truce, and that a ceasefire is only possible if negotiation advances regarding substitution of illicit economies and an end to hostilities against the civilian population. Analysts are seeing the announcement as a likely end of the bilateral ceasefire, though no official declaration has been made. And former President Álvaro Uribe could face justice in Argentina after a complaint was filed in Buenos Aires by 11 victims and three human rights organizations relating to disappearances and extrajudicial execution of civilians by security forces during the civil conflict, a scandal known in Colombia as the False Positives. This case comes under the principle of universal jurisdiction, the idea that certain crimes are so serious that the duty to prosecute transcends borders. These include crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, and torture. The group say that Argentina is one of the countries that does incorporate universal jurisdiction and has experience in the successful prosecution of crimes committed by the state. Cases against security forces of Venezuela, Nicaragua, Myanmar, and Spain are all currently being investigated there. Those were your headlines, so let's get into this week's episode of Colombia Calling, Inside the Narco Files. Hello, Nathan. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Emily.
Thanks to Narco Files, this week has been an extraordinary week for journalism on organized crime and on illicit industries. You've had 40 outlets in 23 countries using this huge document leak from the Colombian Attorney General's office. I'm in awe. I've got so many tabs open. I've got so many articles to read. But let's go back to the start. How did these documents end up in the hands of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project?
It has been a crazy week, and it's, you know, an effort of more than a year. Basically, more than a year ago, I was in Colombia, in Bogota, and we got knowledge that there was this leak, that the prosecutor office had been hacked, and there was a huge leak of emails. At that time, we met with some Colombian colleagues, and it was like a bit of secret because we wanted to share the same information. We knew that the other one knew, but we were not talking about it. So I remember that one of the first persons I talked about is with a Colombian colleague. And he noted in a napkin, it was in Crepes and Waffles in Bogota, where he put in the napkin Fiscalía. And I was, I wanted to talk with you about that and everything. And this is how it really started. And a few other colleagues from other independent media started also to gather around, and we started meeting together. So there was a way to get access to the hacked material, and there are two organizations that we've worked with, mainly one based in the US. It's called DDoS Secrets, and basically they distribute leaks. So they are kind of an in-between institution that is in contact with hacker organizations, and then they distribute that to media or whoever they find it fit for that. I mean, they go by their own interests.
Right. And are they a collective or an NGO, or who and why are they?
Yeah, they are a collective. It's led by a person's name, Emma Best, but it's a team, and it's kind of a layer between the hackers and the journalists. And they have a web page, and you can go and check, and there are tons of leaks that are available. Some of them you can directly download them from their web page, and some of them you have to get in touch with them and basically say that you're a journalism organization and that you want to get into the leak and get information from the leak. So you want to report that for public interest. And I mean, they will decide if they give you access or they don't, basically. That's on them. But yeah, so, and there was another organization called Enlace Activista that has a few leaks, and that was also doing a kind of the similar job, like giving access to the leak to the journalists. So that's how it worked. So we were a certain number of media organizations that had access to the leak. So that's also when we also took a decision that it was better to work together than starting like trying to compete and see who would publish first, because of course the size of the leak we are talking about more than 7 million emails that were hacked. So even if you are like 10 or 20 organizations, it's nearly impossible to work on that on your own. So it was really important to work together and to make this decision of working on a collaborative way instead of, you know, like competing and trying to scoop one another. We had seen exactly happening the same thing in Mexico. I don't know if you remember, but there was this Sedena leak that was about the defense secretary of Mexico. It's also a huge leak. It's kind of the same leak. It's an email leak from the same hacker group, Guacamaya, with the same vulnerability. But there they didn't organize them themselves, and basically it was really like the Wild Wild West, like everyone shooting at the same time. So it made a lot of noise, and in the end there were interesting things that appeared, but not a coordinating efforts on a single topic, right?
Right. Because so many of these stories, for example, the story about banana companies funding Centro Democratico candidates and imports into Europe, it's a multinational story. So the Italian outlet that's worked with Voragine, they've both published these stories and enriched each other's reporting in these in these really remarkable ways. I'm wondering about Guacamaya. Do we know much about, are they an anarchist organization like Anonymous? Do they have a political motivation? Do we know anything about them?
So, I mean, we know a few press releases that have been attributed to them that were published in Enlace Activista webpage. So it's a strange organization because, I mean, we don't really know who is behind that or if there are other interests that are unknown. There are many rumors, of course, but basically, they have like a sort of Native American indigenous discourse on Mother Earth and like these kind of concepts where they put that up in front of their communication and saying that they are defending Mother Earth and they are going after the ones that are basically harming the people and the nature and everything. So they have like this discourse that we could say maybe, like indigenous left-leaning, but it's really, you know, bizarre, but because, for instance, for the Fiscalía leak, the prosecutor, the Colombian prosecutor office, they say it's very corrupt, but they say at the same time that this was like working for Álvaro Uribe Vélez and he was like Colombia president like 15 years ago. And they build on this and on this corruption and everything. So in the end, it's really, we've worked on other leaks, like Panama Papers, or we at OCCRP also worked on a Credit Suisse leak almost 2 years ago. And it was really clear what was the purpose of the source of and in the case of Credit Suisse, the source was really trying to complain about lack of transparency in the Swiss bank and the kind of clients they were getting. So it was really, the intention was really clear. And here it's really like a lot of big words, a very long press release, but there is no intention like, okay, I mean, it's, so they are saying, it's a corrupt institution and, you know, they used to work with the paramilitaries like 15 years ago. And this is an institution that is working for the wealthy and is working also for the U.S. interest and this kind of discourse, like kind of anti-imperialism, indigenous discourse. But it's not so crystal clear what is their intention. It's more like a lot of big words and concepts, but it's interesting.
And obviously the fact that they're working internationally, if it was them in Mexico as well, because these are, while very much in the public interest, these leaks, it is a criminal offense in both countries to hack into and release emails, so one can understand why you would want to be in the shadows.
No, of course. I mean, and with all the leaks in general, you have some leaks that come from a whistleblower or some leaks that come from a hack. But, I mean, of course, the fact that they remain anonymous is really key for them, but also to be able to get this kind of information. But here they, there was an issue with a security issue with the Microsoft Exchange server.
And they were warned, weren't they? And they just didn't.
Yeah, all these institutions were warned, all the clients, all Microsoft's clients.
It's incredible.
But they didn't put the required patches. So that's basically the Guacamaya hackers find found a way through and they reproduce the same attack in several institutions. So it's not only the SEDENA, the Mexican Defense Secretary, that is huge and the leak is bigger than the Fiscalía one.
Mm.
It's also the Army of Colombia, the Peruvian Army,
wow.
Chile Army, El Salvador Police.
Gosh.
There are smaller institutions in Colombia like Agencia Nacional Hidrocarburos. Yeah, the ones that oversee the oil permits and everything, and also some private companies, so some mining companies and things like that. So I mean, they really went and found like this, I would say, open door for them. Once they opened it, they tried to open
right.
it in several places, and you know, so yeah, I mean, I don't know if they're international or if they're of the same country, we don't know that, but they found a way to enter into Latin America's secrets, basically.
And it really is just an extraordinarily large number of documents. So I'm wondering how you even begin to sift through that much information. What are your first steps when you get a leak this big?
So we are talking about 38,000 files. So,
oh my God.
Of course, having that in a computer is crazy, or you could eventually, but you would never be able to open one after another, you know, I mean, that would be crazy.
Right.
So some colleagues started, for instance, identifying the key prosecutors that they knew that were having... running the case against Odebrecht, let's say. So going to the file and trying to get information through this file. But of course, it's still, you know, 38,000 is crazy, and you could spend a whole life.
It's amazing,
and you know. So basically we have like some systems that allows us to upload and to organize the data in a way where you can make like searches with keywords or chains of words or associating words or filter by date or by type of documents,
right.
These kind of things. So this is, of course, like something that was really important and made our lives way easier. So we could really start, you know, identifying and being a bit more systematic when searching documents. So, yeah, I don't know, when you search for someone, I don't know, everyone, I guess, has like a list of persons or some obsessions that we might have, and we start... searching and you know, I don't know, maybe you probably have some names in the top of your heads that you would, you know, be curious to know if there is something. So yeah, I mean, that's really how it begins, and in the beginning, you, of course, you don't know what is in there, and you need time just to kind of make sense of what kind of information you can find, what are
right.
the trends coming out, and everything. But, you know, I mean, it's, yeah, can be infinite.
It starts in this very cloaks and daggers in a cafe with a napkin way, which could be from a spy movie from any decade. And then you have to almost immediately move into these very high-tech ways of dealing with documents because the bulk is so enormous. I mean, how does it feel to sit down in front of this database and just have this, you know, almost open book of the Fiscalía?
From personal point of view, it's, of course, very exciting. There are different type of leaks, of course, and we've worked on other leaks, you know, that can be boring or can be a lot of numbers or, you know,
right,
that you don't have a lot of myth, if I would say. I mean, here these are like documents where, you know, you, it's not just like, I don't know, 1 million transactions. That is very interesting, and you maybe get like big stories out of that, but it's very dry. Right. Here you have like more information because you have like access to, you know, court documents, investigations, wiretaps. So I don't know, from like funny things where you can, you know, learn a bit of criminal slang because they are being wiretapped to, of course, more worrying things where you see a bit like, you know, things that are not going well inside or things like that.
Right. Yeah. I'm trying to imagine, because there were just, and still are, I think, probably millions of stories that these documents could have produced and still are producing. And I'll be sharing with our subscribers and supporters my top stories with translations where useful. So what were the keywords that you were interested to choose? Because I know you've mentioned Odebrecht. Uribe is obviously always a topic when it comes to Colombian recent political history, corruption, links to paramilitaries, etc. What other elements of Colombian politics and corruption were you on the hunt for?
Oh, CCRP, so the organization I work for, we are really into a global network of journalism and into cross-border stories. So we were really trying to look at what were the stories that could go beyond Colombia and not making this like a leak about Colombia or a leak about the Fiscalía,
right,
but more like a point of entry into something bigger that could, you know,
absolutely
make us all work together, as you said, for instance, like Colombians and Italians. And of course, I mean, there are other, you know, criminal things that are also transnational, like migration, illegal, you know, like illegal migration and the persons that profit from that, environmental crime, corruption also. But it was difficult not to see that drug trafficking was so present in the league, because I mean, Colombia is number one producer of cocaine in the world, and is a it's a country that cooperates a lot with other law enforcement. So we could see like how there was also a lot of interest from authorities from other countries. Mainly into that. It soon became clear that this was like the topic that we wanted to start working on first before others, because there is a lot of information, but also it's transnational topic by essence, I guess. And
of course,
also, you know, it's been like war on drugs for 50 years, and it also shows the, you know, the failure and this constant reinvention of war on drugs that never ends. So that's
right,
also
yeah,
something that we had in mind when choosing also this focus. But of course, I mean, you could find a lot of more human stories. I don't know. I mean, I find drug traffickers from Colombia that appeared like drone, like in the Pacific, in a small Pacific islands. I don't know who they were, but it's not necessarily like an investigation into global organized crime or something. It can also be another type of story.
Yeah, I feel very convinced that this leak will be producing stories for months to come. And I'd love to get into the content a bit. And like I said, I've just got a million tabs open. I've read a million. There's just a plethora of incredible reporting that's happened over the last year and come out this week. And we've had top politicians in Suriname. We've had huge Colombian banana companies. The bananas that I'm sure a lot of the people listening to this podcast eat on a weekly basis. These are the sorts of companies we're talking about, the major exporters. We've got Israeli mafia in Colombia. We've got the Odebrecht scandal. There's so much to get into. What for you are the top stories to come out of this leak?
you will get me into trouble, but
I'm not asking you to play favorites, but I also am.
Yeah. So we had stories that, I mean, OCCRP, we were coordinating on one hand, but we're mm-hmm. also producing stories. I think one of the stories I preferred from, at least from our end, is the cocaine relocation story, because we want to show what's new also. I mean, the... Mm. How they are, criminals are adapting, how they are innovating, and we started like finding like some transcripts of tapped phones where criminals were saying, yeah, I mean, we've been trying to start like coca fields in Guatemala, and yeah, it's starting to have a good quality and na-na-na. So that was like, oh, wow. So, I mean, this is interesting because, I mean, this is really, you know, like seeing like a company that, you know, it's Narcotics Inc. And then you are changing the way that you are producing and finding new ways of production. So, we found that they are really trying to produce coca in Central America and also in Southern Mexico, but also setting up like big labs in Europe. So this was a really interesting story because it was really about how the industry is transforming and changing and how it's all connected also with Colombian current situation and you probably maybe have already done a podcast about how coca prices are falling like in the Colombian countryside and everything. So it's all this thing that is changing. This story was really interesting. A colleague also worked on a story about port hacking. So this is about how criminal groups are working with hackers that get into the IT port system. Now, I mean, this is mostly like in Northern Europe, like in the big mm-hmm. ports like Rotterdam and Antwerpen. And each container has like a PIN number. And once you get into the IT system, you can first manage and manipulate the system so the container is less likely to be scanned by custom officers. But you can also check what are the safer lines. So, for instance, maybe safer to use like a container with ornamental plants instead of bananas, or this company has good rep, so maybe it won't be, you know, checked. This story was really interesting because also it's like the conjunction of, you know, shipping and hackers and everything. So that one was pretty interesting.
So to go into the process a bit of how one of these stories would work, what's the origin document, for example, in this hacking port story? What's the starting point and how does it develop from there?
It really depends on the story, but we took a long time also because we were trying to, you know, take like what we had in the leak really as a starting point. And many times it's 80 or 90% of the material and the proofs we get are not from the leak, but are from any other kind of sources like FOIA requests, but also you know, other documents we can get from law enforcement or prosecutors in other parts of the world, all kind of registries, sources, you know, human sources as well. So it really depends. And for instance, with the hacker, there was like just a few documents saying that this was a trend, like in the leak. And at the same time, we saw like a Europol document, but that was public, you know, saying that this was a trend and everything. So this, when we started like connecting the dots and we say, yeah. And then our colleagues that made the story got like access to more documents and to more sources and everything. So kind of sometimes the leak was really important. Sometimes it was really more like a spark to start being interested on something or working on something. So it really depends. But in other cases, as I told you, for instance, the labs and everything, this was a very good complement because we started with these wiretaps, you know, showing that so this is happening and this is interesting. And this was like colleagues from Guatemala, and each one was trying to, you know, search from some leads from their countries, and they came out with this lead and were that's interesting. And then we had other, you know, leads with the labs and everything, showing how Colombians and Mexicans were going back and forth and setting up these labs. And that's when we said, it could be a good story to do like this cocaine relocation story. But in general, we really complemented a lot of the information from the leak. The leak is just the starting point in general, because it sounds huge, but at the same time, it is a picture that is kind of frozen in time, and right. You don't always get, you never get the full picture out of this leak or any other leak in general, and we really wanted to avoid, you know, like the kind of journalism where you find two interesting documents and you publish and you make a lot of noise about it, but no, trying to go deeper.
And of course, all the outlets that were collaborated with have incredible reputations. It's not, there was a leak, here's what the leak says. It's, here is some serious reporting inspired by a leak.
With leaks like this, or, you know, like big leaks that can be eventually global, we search for collaborators that we know already or that,
right.
that have worked with us before in the countries where we see that it's possible that they might be interested. And we everyone starts really searching for leads of their own countries. And this is really the importance of a network where, you know, you might know about Colombia, you might know about UK, but you probably don't know about Paraguay. And that's why we work with someone from Paraguay, or that's why we work with someone from the Netherlands or Belgium, and, you know, because they have a knowledge, this is not really new, this is like old stuff, or they know, this name is really, you know, this guy is really a kind of legit businessman, but the documents are showing that he's like involved in drug traffic. So this is the kind of leads that you could never come up with, even if you have, you know, all the time of the world, and you know, you will always need to work with local partners that have the real knowledge. So you really start setting up this kind of global network of journalists, and they each start, you know, digging on their sides into the league, and then we start, you know, seeing what's emerging out of it and what are the trends and what is the shape of the project in the end.
Because one of the really fascinating elements about this relocation story is that Europe is not merely the destination of cocaine anymore. There are now laboratories, and the raw materials of cocaine, coca paste, are arriving and then being processed in Europe, which just opens up a whole new world of reporting on that side of the Atlantic. And one of, it seems, an enormous number of efforts by these groups to minimize transport costs and risks by bringing the product closer to its final usership, I suppose would be the word.
If you take out, I mean, the illegality of it, there are, I mean, of course, there is a lot of violence, but I read a book that's called Narconomics. It's quite good, and I recommend it.
Yeah, great one.
It really explains how most of these decisions are really business-like and clever, and you know, it's not anarchy and you know, like Wild West guys like shooting everywhere, and you know, it can happen, of course, but. Yeah. They take decisions that are logical in a capitalistic economy, and
right.
with, you know, so in that sense they want to cut they want to cut expenses, they want to be closer to their markets, to their customers, if I may say, but yeah, and they want to cut risks. So in that sense, I mean, the approach of some of the stories is really looking at it as, you know, as almost
as business,
like an economical phenomenon, and as business. Yeah,
that's a fascinating lens to put on it, because it clarifies everything. If you're not treating this as a business, I think you can be quite blinded to some of the absolute logic of it. There's a really interesting essay by Mark Grief in his collection Against Everything, which is also about how the drug trade is not outside of capitalism, it's exactly capitalism. It's pure capitalism. It's not even a type of capitalism. It's the very core of capitalism's set of values. It's from the magazine N+1. It's a brilliant collection of essays about a number of things, but this one in particular is very, very memorable. Brilliant writer, highly recommend. And it becomes a type of business journalism then. And because of the fragmentation of the cartels, you've got this incredibly complex set of brokers and shippers and production lines, because it's no longer vertically integrated. So is journalism on organized crime more difficult than it used to be? Because it's not just Escobar and a vertically integrated chain of crops, production, and then export.
The model is, yeah, has radically changed when you compare it with, you know, when people think about, you know, narco, the first image is like the Chapo or, you know, Escobar,
right,
or the Cali cartel, where, you know, they really kind of controlled the whole chain. And now that's, you know, no longer true. And for journalists, but also for law enforcement, I mean,
right,
of course, you're not facing a guy like Escobar that was like in an open war, and you know, like killing everyone,
yes,
and you live in Medellin, and you know what's his past, but but of course, I mean, to understand this, like, I don't know, like big division in a lot of small, very specialized tasks. So you have,
right,
like, yeah, I don't know, like also the scuba divers that work for the narcos and whose work is to, you know, stick a torpedo full of cocaine in the bulk of a ship, and then they, you know, travel to Istanbul and get it back, like, a month later from the same ship. And,
gotta say, that sounds like a fun job. If I had to pick a role in the chain, that sounds like one of the fun ones.
Yeah, so it's really
so service provision. Yeah, is often what we're talking about, isn't it?
Well, it's the criminal service industry. So, I mean, of course, absolutely, this kind of jobs, but also all the financial jobs and the lawyers and the bankers.
And the laundering and the shell company creation and all of
exactly.
that. Is it harder from a storytelling point of view? Because we know that the Narcos, capital N, brackets Netflix story, kind of took hold because it's an easy story to tell. It's got your main characters. It's got a kind of core group that you can tell a story from. Is it harder or more challenging to create strong narratives out of this new environment?
We also worked in corruption stories and offshore and things. And this is terribly difficult to write or to tell about.
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, there are some very, very, very dry stories. Here, I mean, many times you still have like these very colorful characters. Of course, it's complicated and you know, life is complicated and we really try to not oversimplifying too much and we try to give, you know, complex stories and publish complex stories that show, you know, all the grays and not, you know, something like just black and white. The stories about drug traffic and things are difficult, but I would say easier than, I don't know, like really like the financial stories and this kind of, you know, investigative stories.
And in online media, it's so necessary, not just because there's so much content and so much competition, but because of what we're saying, where you're the bloke with the moustache and the gold toilet is a much easier grab for a reader than the nine shell companies that the banana company, who seems to be very, you know, that it's not just for a reader, but, you know, as a freelance journalist, it's tough to sell to editors something that doesn't have a main character, which is almost part of the genius of the new world of organized crime, is that all of the main characters are invisible and hidden by these very complex legal structures. And I'm wondering, in terms of characters, in terms of people, or even political groups, who's been the most stung by these revelations and this reporting?
Of course, I think that, for instance, the story on Banacol is really strong. So this is a story that IRP, an Italian partner, has been working for a long time with Boragine from Colombia. At one point, they start seeing that this company was, you know, paying a lot of candidates from Centro Democratico in Colombia. So this was, of course, really, really, I mean, a surprise and a really, you know, impressive thing. It was not the main axis in the beginning of the investigation. But of course, the fact that we published like a week after the election, and this was not, you know, made on purpose. We wanted to publish before, but there were the election, and we said, you know, maybe we should wait because everyone is going to be obsessed with elections. And it's, you know, so these are the kind of things that happen a bit like on background. Yeah. That are the reality of this kind of exercise. But, you know, if you can see something with, you know, the power of drug trafficking, of its money, of its, you know, it's not even about a single political group or left or right or an ideology. They have the capacity to adapt and to go everywhere and to, you know, and that's, you know, if it would be a lot easier if it would be, I mean, these are, you know, the ones that are really corrupt and we can focus on them and everything. But I mean, sadly, it's a lot more complicated, and kind of this dark money can, you know, go in any pocket.
Yeah, so I suppose the question is then, what's next? Because these documents are already from the Fiscalía. So this is information that's already within the legal system. But at the same time, it begs the question, is this going to lead to new investigations, new prosecutions, a level of public outrage that demands treatment of some sort of certain people? What's the impact? The aguacate guy is going off. Actually, I think it's the chatarra guy now. Amazing. Bit of texture for the listeners.
So we have also investigations where you can see that actually the Fiscalía had information, for instance, on all the Brecht lobbyists, that they were also working for the narcos at the same time when they were working with Odebrecht. And all these guys kind of got away with the narco part because they kind of collaborated with the Fiscalía on the Odebrecht scandal. And basically, you know, they never used this information and they never connected the dots and or anything. So you can also, you know, I mean, point at internal failures within the prosecutor office,
right?
Where, you know, now that you have a more complete picture as a journalist, thanks to the leak, but also other documents that you can find, and you say, okay, but the Fiscalía knew the same thing, and why haven't they done anything? These are like big questions, or why? You know, they have all this information about a certain group or how it works, but they are still not working together because, I don't know, I mean, the law enforcement world is also very competitive and they don't want to work with each other and a lot of things like that.
Right. Is there any institutional response yet?
So... Yes, I mean, President Petro tweeted and has been like, you know,
I was going to say, was it on his Twitter or was it real?
But, I mean, no, it's interesting because Petro is, you know, like in a sort of confrontation with the actual prosecutor. So, of course, he used this as, you know, like to send him like the prosecutor office should be doing this, you know.
Yes, the animosity between Petro and Barbosa is sort of already at 100 most of the time. So I can imagine this led to some interactions, let's say.
But at the same time, there is a big... I mean, the Twitter is like not your 140 or something character Twitter. Is like, you know, this kind of huge tweets, but where he you know, he has a speech that has, you know, a reflection on the war on drugs and how it's changing and how, you know, it's not a Colombian issue and how this is an issue that, you know, the labs and you know, the criminal groups from everywhere and so he really points that out and saying that we didn't expect this, of course, like, okay, I mean, to have like, you know, this kind of reflection. I think that's the big picture that we will also want to show. And for instance, we had a story that also had elements from the leak. The story was published in May, but I mean, we put it in the package now. This is from 070, is also an independent outlet.
Great outlet.
In Colombia. And they did a very, very good investigation into the killing of Lucas Villa, the student leader, you know, in Pereira.
Yes.
And again, through documents, but also through other things, they really found how police was really close to this drug trafficking organization, La Cordillera, based in Pereira, and how they were, you know, like part of everything that was really murky that was happening when they killed him. So there are these kind of stories that, you know, really point to like really bad functioning of the justice, of the police, of all the dark alliances that can be made. But of course, we also have like a bigger picture that is also important. So yeah.
Certainly the discourse that Petro has had since the start of his presidency and before, that this is an international problem, not a Colombian one. And there's nothing inherently Colombian about the problem. In fact, if anything, it's a US-European problem in that's who the market is very vindicated and evidenced by what's in this report. If it takes a village to raise a child, it seems to take an enormous number of countries and people to get a kilogram of cocaine, I was going to say up someone's nose, but that would probably be fairly lethal, into somebody's hands where they can then sell it. And it's great. It's great to see that international cooperation in the criminal world reflected by international cooperation in the journalistic world. Now that we've seen the incredible success of this project, that is just an absolute triumph, I think. What's next for OCCRP in Latin America? What are you guys brewing up next?
The whole team has been working like mad for a year.
Yeah, a big holiday? A big group holiday?
That's the first thing. We are, of course, as you said, this is a big leak, so probably more stories out of it coming, maybe on other topics, environmental crimes. We do have some stories, and there will be a few more, like will be published in the coming days. Also, the migration and the groups profiting from migration. I think that's a big topic right now in Latin America.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of that in the league. And yeah, I mean, in general, I don't know. I mean, right now everyone is like, okay, but now let's do this, let's do that, let's do more on trends that we are seeing and ports, for instance, and the story from Buenaventura port, where they have a shareholder that was a narco, and Buenaventura port in the Pacific Ocean is one of Colombia's busiest, if not the busiest one of Colombia.
It's a great story.
So this is also, we are also seeing if, well, we should maybe check, you know, who is owning the ports in Latin America. So this opens up a lot of new roads and new ideas. But there is work, you know? There is a lot of work.
It certainly seems like it. Once I get these million tabs closed, I'm really stoked to see what you guys bring out next so I can open another million to read. Thank you so much, Nathan. It's been enlightening.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Emily. Let's speak soon about another million tabs open, and I'm very happy to be here.
Thanks so much, Nathan.
The Colombia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Colombia Calling website, that's www.colombiacalling.co, or the BNB Colombia Tours website. That's www.bnbcolombia.com. And they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.
For the ones who get it done, the most important part is the one you need now. And the best partner is the one who can deliver. That's why millions of maintenance and repair pros trust Grainger. Because we have professional-grade supplies for every industry, even hard-to-find products. And we have same-day pickup and next-day delivery on most orders. But most importantly, we have an unwavering commitment to help keep you up and running. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.